Shalom, and thank you for listening at BethEmmanuel.org. Beth Emmanuel teaches Messianic Judaism for all nations, and we would like to be your long-distance congregation. If you listen regularly at BethEmmanuel.org, consider supporting us with regular financial gifts and become a virtual member. Click on the Donate tab at BethEmmanuel.org to learn more.
The last Torah portion in the book of Genesis is called Vayechi, which means, "And he lived." It refers to the life of Yaakov Avinu, Jacob our father, and it says, "And Jacob lived in the land of Egypt 17 years. So the days of Jacob, the years of his life, were 147 years. The story then goes on to describe Jacob's deathbed farewells to his sons and grandsons. And we read about how Jacob sits up on his bed to meet Joseph and his sons and how he prepares for death by investing them with blessings and elevating Ephraim and Manasseh to the level of his sons and speaking the blessings of his fathers, Abraham and Isaac, over them. And then he goes on to summon all of his sons to speak words of farewell to them in the form of parting blessings over each one. At the conclusion of it all, he gives his sons some final instructions. It says in Genesis 49:29, "Then he commanded them and said to them, 'I am to be gathered to my people.'" What does it mean when he says, "I am about to be gathered to my people"? It's obviously a euphemism for death. It means, "I'm about to die." In Genesis 25:8, the Torah describes the death of Abraham the same way. It says, "Abraham breathed his last and died in a good old age, an old man full of years, and was gathered to his people." Likewise, Genesis 35:29, when Isaac dies, the Torah says, "And Isaac breathed his last, and he died, and was gathered to his people, old and full of days." Jacob says to his sons, "I am to be gathered to my people. Bury me with my fathers in the cave that is in the field of Ephron the Hittite, in the cave that is in the field at Machpelah, to the east of Mamre, in the land of Canaan, which Abraham bought with the field from Ephron the Hittite to possess as a burying place. There they buried Abraham and Sarah his wife. There they buried Isaac and Rebekah his wife. And there I buried Leah. The field and the cave that is in it were bought from the Hittites." When Jacob finished commanding his sons, he drew up his feet into the bed and breathed his last and was gathered to his people. I once read a scholar who suggested that the term "gathered to his people" referred to being interred into a family tomb, one in which one's ancestors' bones were collected, and that the dead were said to be gathered to their people because they were buried with them. Maybe that is the origin of the expression, but Abraham was a long way from the bones of his ancestors when he was laid in the Machpelah tomb in Hebron. Likewise, Jacob is a long way from the bones of his fathers in Hebron when he dies in Goshen, Egypt, and yet it says he breathed his last and was gathered to his people. He hasn't been carried to Hebron yet. Joseph will have him embalmed and then create a great funeral procession to escort Jacob's body to the tomb of Abraham in Hebron, the Machpelah tomb, but that hasn't happened yet. And yet it says he was gathered to his people. Rashi comes and offers us some insights on the expression. The verb asaf means to gather, usually implying gathering together something that has been scattered, but Rashi would prefer that in this particular case, rather than translate the term, the verb as gather, that we recognize that the verb asaf also has the sense that it can also be used to mean to bring in, and he gives several examples. And this is how he would translate it: "I shall be brought in to my people." He was brought in to his people, and Rashi explains why he translates it, why he prefers it this way. He says, "Because they bring in the souls to the place where they are stored away." Where is the place where the souls are stored away? Well, regarding the righteous, the Talmud says they are stored beneath the throne of glory, in the place of reward, and so forth. There's another expression that we use in Judaism to speak about those who have passed on ahead of us and where they are stored away until the resurrection of the dead. And this one comes from the story of David and Abigail. When Abigail blesses David, she says, "The life of my Lord, the soul of my Lord, shall be bound in the bundle of the living with the Lord your God." To be bound in the bundle of the living. She says, "Hayata nefesh tzurura betziror hachayim." The soul, the nefesh, will be It's beautiful in Hebrew and in English, to be bound in the bundle of the living. It means to be ushered into the world of souls and granted the repose of the righteous. So on Jewish headstones, we commonly see an acronym for these words. May his soul be bound in the bundle of the living, in the bundle of life. So what does it mean then to be gathered to your people? And what does it mean to be bound in the bundle of life? What happens to a person at the moment of death? Rashi says, they bring in the souls to the place where they are stored away. Who brings them in? Who's they? The story of one of our own fathers in faith, Paul Philip Levertov, holds an important clue. Paul Philip Levertov was struck by a debilitating stroke on Good Friday of 1954 while teaching about the suffering of the Master. He entered into his share of that suffering and never fully recovered. Instead, he languished on for several months, through the spring and most of the summer, before dying on July 31st, Rosh Chodesh Av. After his passing, his wife Beatrice wrote a beautiful article and reported to his readers as follows. She said, "His thoughts were constantly with heavenly things. The things of earth became of no moment. In delirium, he spoke only of spiritual things, of God, of his desire to adequately express his love for God. To everyone who came to see him, he soon turned every talk to such matters. At such moments, he would rally to such an extent that, even to the last, those who visited him could hardly grasp the frail hold he now had on earthly life." She said that Levertov had often expressed remorse over leaving his parents and family behind when he became a disciple. By then, of course, they had since passed on. In his last hours, however, he found peace. Beatrice said, "He often felt that if he had been wiser, he would have gained his father, for he realized how near the kingdom he was. He dedicated one of his books to his father, an Israelite in whom there is no guile. To his father, his grandfather, and to his mother's uncle, the famous Rabbi Schnur Zalman, he felt he owed his own preparation for and understanding of the teaching of Jesus. In his last hours, he talked with them and assured me that they were now of the kingdom and awaiting his coming." When I first read these words from Paul Levertov's wife, I was deeply impressed and even moved at the thought of Schnur Zalman, the first Lubavitcher Rebbe, visiting the bedside of his grandnephew and assuring him, along with Levertov's mother Yehudis and his father Shaul and Levertov's grandfather as well, of their place in the kingdom. According to his daughter Denise, Paul Levertov got out of bed and danced a Hasidic dance at that hour. My father tells a story of a friend of his, an army buddy, who on his deathbed was observed speaking with an unseen visitor. When the man's wife tried to talk to her dying husband, he waved her away and said, "Shh," and then turned back to the conversation with the invisible visitor. Assuming he was hallucinating, his wife again tried to speak to him, perhaps to bring him out of the delirium, but again he scolded her, saying, "Shh, Jesus is talking to me." 2 years ago, during the Festival of Sukkot, when Toby Janicki's father, Harry Janicki, was dying, he was at the end of a long decline with Alzheimer's disease, and he really could no longer communicate and did not know where he was or who he was, for all anyone knew. But one day, when Toby's wife Shannon was alone in the house with Harry, she could tell he had something to say and was trying to speak, so she encouraged him to speak his mind even though he had serious aphasia and could no longer verbally convey ideas or string together complete sentences. But astonishingly, he clearly said, "The Lord is coming back soon," Shannon asked. "For you, Harry?" He replied, "No, for everyone." Later that same day, he spoke again. He remarked that he could see angels passing by, and he observed that they were beautiful. Now, if you knew Harry, you knew that he didn't talk like this. We might have expected Toby's mom to talk like this, but Harry was not what you would call spiritually minded or spiritually inclined. The coming of the Lord and the appearance of angels were not the type of things he would be likely to be speaking about if he could speak. And that was the other interesting thing, that these were rare moments of lucid communication. A few days later, he passed away. Hospice workers who see death routinely are accustomed to these types of things. Hospice literature tells you that it's not unusual for the dying to speak with unseen visitors, and we are cautioned against interrupting these conversations. In a response to an article on the subject, Rebecca Valla, a psychiatrist who specializes in treating terminally ill patients, wrote, "They are very common among dying patients in hospice situations. Those who are dying and seem to be in and out of this world and the next one often find their deceased loved ones present, and they communicate with them. In many cases, the predeceased loved ones seem, to the dying person, to be aiding them in their transition to the next world. Family members are often clueless about this phenomenon, at the outset at least. A small 2014 study of hospice patients concluded that most participants reported such visions, and that as these people approached death, comforting dreams or visions of the deceased became more prevalent." There's some interesting, unexplainable items about deathbed visions, that the visions people experience at the end of life are remarkably similar. This is a remarkably similar story from case to case. And the dying are most often reporting that they are visited by their mothers. And you can see sometimes, very often, hands passionately reaching upward to some unseen force. And the visions often occur toward a specific corner of the room. Many people on the deathbed who have subsequently recovered or rallied for a short while have told about the visitors. Sometimes they speak of angels, beautiful beings of light. Sometimes they speak of the presence of parents, friends, family members, extended family, uncles, aunts, even children they have lost, and so forth. And sometimes they speak about the presence of our Master Yeshua. There are several documented cases in the literature of near-death experiences that tell of visits by friends or family members who were otherwise assumed to still be alive and only subsequently discovered to have recently passed away without the previous knowledge of those receiving the visitation. I heard a poignant anecdote about one patient who went into crash mode, but the hospital staff revived him. And then he told them that he had had a near-death experience in which he saw relatives waiting for him, but he was puzzled because also one of the nursing staff was in the vision. And it was later found out that this particular nurse had indeed died earlier that afternoon in a car accident. So I'm sometimes asked if we will recognize our loved ones in heaven. Not only will we recognize our loved ones, but family members literally await us, come to meet us, and escort us. It's like the old hymn, "In the sweet by and by, we shall meet on that beautiful shore." Or, like one of my favorite spirituals, "If I get to heaven before you do, I will meet you at the station when your train comes along. I'll be watching and waiting, mother dear, for you. I will meet you at the station when your train comes along." In near-death experiences, it's often one of these family members who says to the nearly deceased, "It's not your time yet. You have to go back." And there are many stories of people who have met otherwise unknown siblings or other family members they did not know that they had, and after returning and telling about the experience, finding out from family that there was such a person and that the details, and in some cases the name, even the names match. To me, all of this indicates that there is a spiritual connection among family members that transcends mere flesh and bone and DNA. We share a soulish connection with our family members, and that connection does not seem to be severed by death. In other cases, as with the story of Toby's father, one sees angelic beings sent to escort the soul into the next world. This is in keeping with what our master says in the parable of the rich man and poor Lazarus. He says, "The poor man died and was carried by the angels to Abraham's side," that is, to Abraham's table. In near-death experiences, the experiencer often reports encountering these otherworldly beings of light, which form a sort of escort through the process, perhaps escorting them through the tunnel and toward the ultimate light, or however, whatever they're seeing. The sages say that escorting the dead is a mitzvah for which a person received reward both in this world and the world to come. And it refers to escorting the dead, refers to taking care of the body from death until burial. It includes all of the funeral the ceremony and preparations of the deceased and sitting shomer, and then literally following the casket to burial, literally escorting to the cemetery, the funeral procession. In Jewish practice, when you would see a funeral procession, it's a mitzvah then to fall in with the procession and follow the casket. So we follow the coffin. And as you do, as the casket is moving, we recite Psalm 91, which begins with the words, "He who dwells in the shelter of the Most High will abide in the shadow of the Almighty," and so forth. But it has these important words. It says in verse 11 and 12, "For he will command his angels concerning you to guard you in all your ways. On their hands they will bear you up." It seems to me that this practice of escorting the dead, the mitzvah of escorting the dead, for which there's a reward in this world and in the world to come, is a reflection of what is actually happening to the dead in the world of souls. Why do you need an escort? To make sure you get where you are supposed to be going, because some souls are confused, some are still deeply attached, and some are reluctant to leave. When the 15-year-old Israeli boy, Natan, had his experience, he felt like he left his body, exited through his nose, actually, and at first he floated above himself, and at first he didn't understand who he was and where his self was anymore. He said, "I simply felt like I suddenly left my body, and then I saw myself in the bed. I was simply 2 meters above my bed, and I didn't understand if that was me there, then who am I here? Or who is the one above my bed?" And I wasn't able to understand it. In some cases, the soul is reluctant to leave the Bar Kaparatat. Until 3 days after death, the soul keeps on returning to the grave, thinking that it will go back into the body. But when it sees that the facial features have become disfigured, it departs and abandons the body. Thus it says, "But his flesh grieves for him, and his soul mourns over him." So this is the kindness of the Holy One, blessed be He. He wants to summon the soul back to His presence, but He knows that the soul may be frightened, confused, uncertain about what has happened and where to go and how to make the transition. And He sends comforters and escorts, familiar friends and family members, to ease the transition from this world to the world of souls. Loved ones come and escort us, and the angels come to escort the righteous, to bear them up on their hands, to carry them on their hands, to set us on the journey to paradise, to the Garden of Eden, to Abraham's table, to heaven, and to the source of all light. Do you see what's happening here? He sends us our people, and we are brought into their gathering. We are gathered to our people. Those who have had this experience with the spiritual escorts describe these spiritual beings as real presences, not necessarily in a sense of looking like a physical body, visible in the spiritual, substantial but not solid. They describe instantaneous communication, not with words, but with knowing, instantaneous empathy and exchange of words without words, knowing and recognition without being told. The Zohar on Parashat Vayechi, in relation to the deathbed of Jacob, says, "We have learnt that at the hour of a man's departure from the world, his father and his relatives gather around him, and he sees them and recognizes them, and likewise all with whom he was associated in this world, and they accompany his soul to the place where it is to abide." A little further on it says, "When a man is ill and his time is approaching to depart from the world, a new spiritual capacity enters into him from above, in virtue of which he sees things which he could not see before, and then he departs from the world. So it is written, 'For man shall not see me and live.' In their lifetime they may not see, but at the hour of death they may. We have further learnt that at the time of a man's death he is allowed to see his relatives and companions from the other world, and if he is virtuous, they all rejoice before him and give him greeting." Once it happened that a cousin of my father appeared to him in a dream sometime after she had died. And my father was astonished when he saw her, because she was young and beautiful, as she was, as he had known her, as a young boy when she was a young girl. Though she died as a mature woman full of years, when she came to speak to him, she was radiant and young again, 20 years old or so, and he observed that she wore a beautiful dress in the style of those days when she had been young. It seems to me that if this is the case, if our family ties are so strong that they extend even beyond the grave, and our family members and our friends wait to greet us and escort us across, then we should not wait until that day to strengthen those bonds and celebrate those relationships, but we should hold one another all the more closely, protecting and nurturing those relationships, cherishing one another all the more dearly. We should not let this world and its busy demands and tyranny of the urgent separate us, nor should we allow the petty hurts and offenses of human ego to sever the ties of love for family, for brothers and sisters, mother and father, husband and wife, and extended family. And if this is the case with our natural families, much more so also among the family of the disciples of our Master, Yeshua tells us that we are to love him more than mother and father, more than brother and sister, more than husband and wife, and we should love one another as he loved us. If this is the case, then we are bound by these ties of love in almost every direction, and even beyond the grave, the bonds of love still hold fast. And this is why we are gathered to our people. And if these beloved ones will greet us and receive us, how much more so will our Master receive us on the other side? Of course, death is frightening. It's a bit like leaping from a bridge into the darkness, uncertain if you're going to drop into the water and survive, or whether the water be hot or cold, or perhaps you're going to hit the stones and perish, or perhaps there is no bottom and you'll just fall in the darkness forever. That does sound frightening. But those in the Messiah need not fear. Yeshua says, "Whoever believes in me, though he die, yet he shall live. And everyone who lives and believes in me shall never die." That means that for those in Messiah, though we die, death will be inconsequential, a passage to further life in the world of souls and ultimately the resurrection of the dead. So disciples of Yeshua need have no fear of death. There's a story in the Talmud about two sages and the fear of death. One sage, Reb Nachman, is dying, and he's afraid to die. He's afraid that the process of leaving the body is going to be painful, and there might be punishing angels present, or the angel of death might torment him. His friend Rava is sitting at his bedside, and as Nachman is slipping into death, he says to Rava, "Please ask the angel of death not to torment me." Rava tries to comfort him. He chides him a little bit. He says, "Are you not a man esteemed by heaven?" But Nachman demurs and says, "Who is esteemed? Who is regarded? Who is distinguished before death?" So then Rava starts to wonder what it's like to pass that threshold. And as Nachman is dying, Rava says to him, "Please come show yourself to me in a dream after you have died." Nachman dies and some short time later shows himself in a dream. And Rava asks him, "Did you suffer pain?" Nachman replies, "No more pain than a hair being removed from milk." This is an interesting analogy. A hair is easily removed from milk, but it resists a little bit because the viscosity of the milk tends to cling to the hair. The liquid clings to the hair and tries to hold it back, but it can offer no real substantial resistance as the hair is drawn out of the liquid. So the implication is that the soul clings only tenuously to the body, but it offers no real resistance as it is drawn smoothly out of the body. One woman who reported a near-death experience after drowning reported that she heard a pop sound, so to speak, and suddenly she found herself above her body looking down at it, feeling a sort of sad remorse for the body and a sense of gratitude for the use of it before the people around her started doing CPR and she was drawn back into her body. In Rava's dream, Rabbi Nachman said, if the Holy One, blessed be He, were to ask me to go back to the world as I was, I would not want to, because over there, the fear of death is so great. And what he means by this is that having crossed over, he no longer had the fear of death. And this is another thing typical of those who have had the near-death experience. After the experience, they have lost their fear of death. How much more so for those of us who will surely be met by the Master? If he has been faithful to us in life, how much more so will he be faithful to us in death? He says, I am with you always. Never will I leave you. Never will I forsake you. He is the living one who is dead and now lives and holds the keys of death and Sheol. And he commands his Father's angels to escort the souls of his faithful. And he gathers us to our people. And he gathers us to himself. As it says, he will command his angels concerning you to guard you in all your ways. On their hands, they will bear you up. He himself will escort his disciples into the presence of his Father, uniting us with our family, gathering us to our people and the family of God, as he says, be faithful unto death, and I will give you the crown of life.
Take on my yoke and learn from me and find rest for your soul.